Thank you, Mr. Niblett, for these kind words of introduction. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a pleasure to return here to CSIS. I was here before in 2001. And as the French say, a lot of water has flown under the bridges. Since then, the world has changed in so many significant ways, so that it's most interesting to be back here with people interested in transatlantic relations and in policy in general. One of the things that's happened in that interim period is that we've taken our place among the community and nations in ways that were forbidden to us for half a century while we were under Soviet rule. And so now the president who stands before you is one of a free and independent Republic of Latvia, a republic that is now a member of the European Union, that is a member of NATO, and that is in fact going to host the next NATO summit in November 2006. Just 15 years ago, and that's an eye blink in the passage of history. A decade and a half ago, we still had the Iron Curtain separating Europe into two parts. We had one part which was growing, prosperous, democratic, evolving, having close links with America, participating in general policy making. And we had a whole other half which was shut off, which was submitted to the dictates of Moscow. The satellites are really satellites in the literal sense of the word, in that they had no foreign policy whatsoever of their own. They had some liberty of decision in their internal affairs, very limited. Everything was dictated from Moscow, and the Baltic states, of course, were completely incorporated as one of the 15 republics. So they had no decision-making power whatsoever over their fates. When the Soviet Union collapsed after the August putsch of 1991, the Baltic states were the ones to seize the opportunity first. They had already declared their independence earlier, but they seized now the opportunity to do it de facto. But I don't know if you're all aware of what they inherited at that moment. The whole Soviet Union had been built on the premise of making it last forever and then conquering the rest of the world. The economy of the Soviet Union was intertwined. It was irrational. It was one of the reasons why it collapsed ultimately, because it was so irrational. But it was meant to forbid any one of the republics, so-called, to ever become independent again, if for no other reason than on economic terms. Even if the military might were to collapse, which it did, the economic intertwining should be such that they shouldn't become independent. Well, they did. They did. They cut the umbilical cord. They restituted private property, switched to market economies, entered competition with the rich countries of Western Europe, survived, continued trade with the Soviet Union, former Soviet Union, the CSIS countries, with Russia and the others. Then the banking crisis of 1998 came. Many companies went bankrupt. They survived. By now, Latvia has 80% of its trade with fellow countries in the European Union. We are completely oriented to the West. And as I say, we are hosting the NATO summit. When my last visit here, the idea of the next NATO enlargement was very hotly debated. It wasn't evident at all. There wasn't agreement. Some voices at that time said, you can't conceive of such a thing. Russia is not going to be happy. And Russia wasn't happy about it, but they lived with it, and they live with it today. Now we're looking forward to a different sort of world. We're part of the European Union, we're part of NATO, and we're fully determined to play our role as partners, as collaborators, but of course with our own voice and our own experience to contribute. As such, we are particularly aware of the importance of the transatlantic link for Europe. And in that sense, so-called New Europe, the one that emerged from behind the Iron Curtain so recently, possibly does have a slightly different take on things than so-called Old Europe. Throughout the years, we have appreciated the support of the United States of America. Just yesterday, I had the honor of participating at the opening of our new premises, the new premises of the Latvian Embassy Chancery here in Washington. We had diplomatic representation here throughout all the years of loss of our independence. The United States not only did not recognize the annexation of the Baltic states, but they recognized our embassies here, our diplomatic representatives, heirs to the diplomats before the war. We remain deeply grateful for that legal continuity which it gave to the Latvian Republic. The current Latvian Republic is the continuity, the legal and direct continuity of the Republic of 1918. And we're looking back on the Soviet time as just a bad dream, which we just as soon forget. The United States, therefore, is and was and will be an important partner for us. We understand the importance of the transatlantic link for Europe. We remember, when some have forgotten, the role that the United States played in the Second World War, in the collapse of Hitler's Germany. We remember how the United States opened its doors to the refugees at a time when many other countries were wondering what to do with them. All these people who had fled from Eastern Europe, who were ready to leave everything behind, but felt they could not live under communism. The United States opened its doors, accepted these people. We still have a Latvian American community here, a thriving one. We're grateful for that as well. But now that we have our independent country again, of course, we feel that this partnership must remain a vibrant and timely one today and tomorrow. It is not obsolete. We cannot turn a page on it. We have to keep it alive. We do not face up to the threats of the Cold War or the ones before. But the world, alas, is always alive with new threats. We are facing today the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. We are seeing constantly new outbreaks of regional conflicts. Terrorism has become a daily occurrence in too many parts of the world. You have seen it here on your own soil. Your territory has not seen war on its own. You haven't seen it on your own land for a long time, but you have seen and experienced terror. And these are the new 21st century challenges. They're challenges to the security of Europe. They're challenges to the security of America and to the whole world. True, America and Europe do not always agree on every question. Of course, who does agree on every question? I don't think any of us agree even in our families on every single question that comes forth. So it's only natural that there are differences of opinion, and certainly significant differences of opinion on certain important points. One of these is the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court. The Netherlands, who have been initiators there, and other European Union countries feel very strongly about it. They feel very strongly about the need for international principles of justice that should apply to everybody. You know very well the position of the United States on that question. This is something on which, for the moment, we must agree to disagree. The signing of the Kyoto Protocol, I think worldwide, is a sore point. Everywhere we are seeing signs of the weather dangerously changing as opposed to even 10 or 20 years ago. Global warming is a fact. I think it's difficult to deny it by now. The question is, what do we do about it? How do we go about doing it? And how soon are we ready to do it? We have differences on that as well. These are disagreements that are important, they're principled. But they mustn't steer us off the course of realizing that we have far more in common than we have differences. And it may be easier for journalists to keep talking about the differences of opinion that we have. I think it's much more difficult, and this is the job of statesmen to work on it, is to find the points of contact, to find the points of agreement, to work on our strengths, to build on our strengths. These are the sort of questions that we hope that the upcoming NATO summit in Riga will be including in its agenda. We would like to have the question of worldwide security considered. We'd possibly like to see invited the global partners of the NATO alliance, those countries that, like Australia, New Zealand, Japan, or South Korea, have been NATO allies de facto in practice in certain international situations, for the simple fact that they share the same values. We would also like to see discussions at this summit, the NATO summit in Riga, about worldwide situation and about the worldwide role that NATO as a security organization can play in it, and that it can play in world security. Conflicts in Africa, for instance, the crisis in Darfur. The African Union has become more active. They've taken initiatives. They've become stronger. It is something we'd like to encourage. The question is, how much are they able to accomplish in practice? How could they link up with the facilities that NATO could offer, or the expertise? We have to think about NATO playing an ever larger role outside of the territories of the member countries of the alliance. The question is, how far should it extend? What form should it take? And what sort of collaboration should NATO engage in with these partners, either the ones on the immediate periphery of NATO territories or these global partners from further away across the globe, but of similar values and intentions? By now we know, and it seems fairly clear, that one of the central themes of the NATO summit in Riga will be to focus on NATO's political and military transformation and on the forms of partnership with the countries at the borders of its territories. No doubt an assessment of the peace process and general situation in the Middle East, it is something that one cannot ignore. And here's an organization that has changed over the years. It has changed since the collapse of the former Yugoslavia. It has currently various challenges it has to face up to. This will be one of the topics, certainly a central topic, that we will have to be discussing. At the moment, NATO is engaged in stabilizing and peacekeeping processes in Afghanistan, and NATO's response force, the NRF, has been skillfully used to deliver a rapid aid to Pakistan following last year's devastating earthquake. Recently, Secretary General Jaap de Hoop Scheffer has announced that he will be pushing hard to ensure that by the time of the Riga summit, end of November, NATO will be able to announce full operational capability for the NRF. You probably know that NATO forces by now and their resources are being used in ways that normally would be considered as peacetime processes. They have begun to be used at international sporting events. NATO AWACS helped to protect last month's Olympic Games in Turin, and they will patrol over the World Cup later this year in Germany. As you know, if you've seen events from the World Cup, you realize that this is quite a challenge and possibly a military one. By the way, we are having the World Hockey Championship in Riga this coming month of May. We are not having NATO support for controlling that. Our fans happen to be extremely good-natured, cheerful, noisy, but good-natured, and we hope that we will be able to cope with our hockey fans without NATO intervention. But it's something to consider, you see, when if they get too enthusiastic. One of the aspects of NATO operations is air-to-ground and ground-to-air surveillance. And this, by now, it's become evident, has to be reviewed across all the territories. The situation in Iceland has changed from what it was during the Cold War. The situation, the airspace in the Baltic States, has now entered. It's become NATO airspace. And the countries concerned, especially the three Baltic countries, would like to see the idea of the control and surveillance of the airspace over our territories as being part of the regular duties of NATO. At the moment, we have a rotation of countries coming in turn to a central airport and being ready to patrol the airspace. And we have a rotation ensured till the end of 2007. Then we will have to look for more permanent solutions. Ladies and gentlemen, as a democratic nation and a country that was democratic before its loss of independence and became democratic again with this unfortunate interruption in between, we are very deeply concerned with the continued democratization of other countries that have embarked about the road to democracy and have set it as their national priority. This is why we firmly believe that an open-door policy must be maintained for the admittance of future member states that meet both the EU's and NATO's requirements. We look forward to welcoming Romania and Bulgaria into the European Union. We're also pleased that the accession talks have begun with Croatia as well as with Turkey. Turkey has been knocking at the doors of the European Union for a very long time. But Turkey, at the same time, was not able to show that it had met the criteria that the European Union sets even for its applicants, never mind its members. This having been done, and Turkey having made profound changes and shown enormous amounts of goodwill, Latvia was one of the countries strongly supporting the idea of beginning accession talks and then judging how Turkey progresses as the chapters and the negotiations are proceeding as they did for all other earlier candidates. We also encourage Macedonia to continue with the reforms it has undertaken as a EU candidate country, as a potential NATO member. We are likely to support the extension of an invitation in 2008 for Croatia to join NATO. And we will support Albania's efforts to fight corruption and organized crime as a possible future NATO member, and we would like to hope that the prospect of future NATO membership would give this country's leaders the added strength and determination to tackle these internal problems, which undoubtedly are very severe. Latvia places a very high importance on the EU's neighbourhood policy, the so-called European neighbourhood policy, which is designed to promote closer relations between our various neighbours. There's a programme for the Mediterranean. There's another programme for the eastern neighbours of the European Union. At the moment, Latvia is devoting concerted efforts to assist the new democracies of Ukraine, of Georgia, and of Moldova. Because our resources are limited, we have chosen these three as our priority. We will support offering NATO's membership action plan to Ukraine as soon as the Riga NATO summit, on the condition, of course, that real progress continues to be made in this country, and, of course, contingent on the elections which they are about to have, the parliamentary elections, the composition of the new parliament, and the decisions they will take. We have to see whether their determination will be as strong as the one that has so far been expressed by President Yushchenko. As you know, both Bosnia-Herzegovina and Serbia-Montenegro have indicated a desire to join the Partnerships for Peace in the NATO programs. If these two countries cooperate fully with the International Criminal Tribunal of the former Yugoslavia, then Latvia will support the extension of partnership invitations to them, but this is a strong precondition. Latvia is one of three European states, EU member states, that border Belarus. As you may imagine, we more than many others are following developments in that country with the gravest of concern. This morning, again, alas, we had more news of the beating, mistreatment, and the arrest of opposition members. Detention, harassment, physical violence have been the order of the day for various youth organizations, independent non-governmental organizations. Things seem to be going rapidly downhill in that country. Until very recently, we still had hopes that with the presence of observers, the elections, the upcoming elections, would be at least a step ahead. That'd be somewhat better than the preceding ones. The recent events, day by day, seem to be erasing that hope. And the question then remains, what can we as neighbours do in such a situation? What can the European Union do? What can America do? Or what can the United Nations do with its member? These are very hard questions and very difficult to answer. We have another neighbour, a much larger one, and that is Russia. Russia has seen itself as the heir to the former Soviet Union. But of course, what we, as also former unwilling members of the Soviet Union, would like to see is a Russia that is able to distance itself from this past, to renounce this past, to embrace new values, to embrace a new course, to set a new image for itself. It is a vast country with vast human and natural resources. It has every potential for becoming a great world power as well as a democratic one. That is our wish for our neighbor, I'm sure one that America can share. We're pleased to see the engagement of Russia and its collaboration with the United States and with others in the international fight against terrorism, We're pleased to participate in a dialogue between the European Union and Russia and the dialogue between Russia and the NATO alliance. However, what we would like to see is having a more normal international type of relation between the three Baltic countries, especially Estonia and Latvia, and Russia, where we simply have not had sufficient political dialogue. Latvia has a number of treaties that have been prepared that await signing with Russia. We have not had exchanges of, say, visits at the prime ministerial level. We would like to see Russia engaging all its neighbours. And, of course, we do hope that this is a country that will not slip back into totalitarian ways, but will be able to keep the road that it engaged on when the future President Yeltsin climbed on that tank and the troops refused to attack the population. That was a turning point, and it is our sincere and profound wish that Russia continues on that road of democratization, that it does not slip back. However, there are concerns in that direction, as no doubt you're aware. The energy dispute, for instance, between Ukraine and Russia at the beginning of this year, highlighted a rather unsettling prospect of energy supplying countries such as Russia using oil and natural gas to obtain political and economic concessions from their client nations. And when you consider the percentage of the total energy that the European Union receives from Russia, you realize that this is not a trivial matter. This is why Latvia, among other countries, feels very strongly that the European Union needs to develop a common energy policy. Energy has been one of the fields where each member country had a lot of latitude in setting its own policies. But there is such a thing as an energy commissioner, happens to be a Latvian, by the way. And the energy commissioner, I think, by now, should be engaging all the member countries in making sure that we have a debate and a dialogue about the energy supply future of the continent, and certainly the Union as a whole. The focus here in these debates should be clearly on diversifying the geographical sources from which Europeans derive their energy, on diminishing Europe's reliance on single large suppliers such as Gazprom, for instance. It should be in everybody's interest in the long run to diversify the types of energy that we use and, of course, finally reduce our dependency on fossil fuels, obviously non-renewable, something I think that the world has been putting off during the whole of the 20th century. And I'm afraid in the 21st century there will come a point where we'll have to face up to it, especially as countries like China and like India and possibly others, Brazil, develop, become industrialized, become equally large consumers of fossil fuels. We are going to be facing a crisis. And I think the time to prepare for it is now. It's not 100 years from now. Ladies and gentlemen, the countries of Eastern Europe have experienced at first hand just how bitter the loss of liberty can be. And this is why we cherish the freedoms that we had lost and that we have regained. We cherish it as a most precious asset. In that sense, we appreciate America's program of not just enjoying the democracy and freedom that it has managed to attain for its people, but also its concern about spreading it in the world. Some will say that this is a missionary zeal that is out of place. We think it's a necessity of life. We cannot conceive of a planet on which we will all feel safe if half of it or more is deprived of the liberties which we considered as elemental rights. In that sense, Latvia is a partner to America in spite of the disparity of our size. We are ready to participate in actions where we see that people's freedoms are menaced and where there is a determination among the people to have them. This is a precondition. If a nation itself, if the people do not feel it in their hearts, that need, then of course you cannot force it down their throats, and it's very difficult to achieve results. But we do feel very strongly, on moral and principled grounds, that there is a reason for participating in these international actions. In Kosovo, we saw what happened without an international presence in the former Yugoslavia. In Afghanistan, we know the history of that part of the world. And in Iraq. We are there, ready to continue supporting the peacemaking efforts. But here's a country, Iraq, where really the people of Iraq have, I think, to reach that awareness and that feeling of commitment that they want to put an end to terror and to bloodshed. And this is a battle that's going on there. Not one, it's not a military battle. It's a battle of the minds. It's a battle of the values. Can people accept a state that is secularized, sufficiently secularized, that religion remains a part of everybody's conscience and of their private life, or if you like, the life of their society, but that the religion doesn't become the excuse for violence and bloodshed and for terrorism? This is something, ultimately, that the people of Iraq will have to come to a conviction about it. And it will be a matter of how many, how large a proportion are willing to continue with fanaticism, to follow the incitations of the mullahs. And when will we reach the tipping point? When enough of the population will say, this is not the way we wish to live. This is not the way we want to bring up our children. We want to live a different life. And I don't think we've reached that point in Iraq. And I think it's a pity to watch that country bleed to death. But ultimately, there's only so much that anybody from outside can do. The future is in the hands of the people of Iraq and of other countries, and of their ability to renounce fanaticism, to renounce terrorism, to renounce violence, and to accept at least at an elementary level those values that we elsewhere in the democracies of the world we have taken for granted. In this fight against terrorism, which is common to the civilized world at large, we must remain strong and we must remain united. However, and this I feel very strongly, and many Europeans share this view, fighting terrorism does not mean that we can refuse to afford fair and humane treatment to enemy combatants and to terrorist suspects. To do otherwise makes us lose our moral legitimacy in our own eyes, as well as the eyes of the world. We should not descend to the baser level of our adversaries. We cannot fight evil with evil. Senator John McCain, a good friend of mine, was himself a victim of torture in Vietnam, has rightly said, and I quote, This battle is about the things we stand for and believe in. And that is an observance of human rights, no matter how terrible our adversaries may be. End of citation. Before coming to America, I just returned from a state visit to Israel. The situation in the Middle East, clearly chronically tense for decades, has entered a new phase of tension, a new challenge following the election of Hamas in the Palestinian territories. The paradox this time is that there was an open and free, and then you would say, democratic vote in the Palestinian territories. And the population elected Hamas with everything that it stands for. Why they did so, of course, could be subject to analysis, much as it's worth analyzing whether the no to the European Constitution in the referenda in France and in the Netherlands was a refusal of the European project, was a rejection of the idea of European enlargement, or was it simply a vote of protest by the extreme right and extreme left against the government in power. You might wonder what that vote in favor of Hamas really meant in the territories. Was it by any chance simply a vote of protest against the Fatah and the corruption that they had seen in this international support that Palestinians had been receiving? Is it really a support for the terrorist aspect of the Hamas project? That is really something that the future will tell. Hamas has received now the endorsement in free and fair elections of the Palestinian people. It seems to me that now is the time for that organization to change its nature. It has a chance now to recognize that democracy and terror do not go together, that having received political power, they have to assume the responsibilities of normal governance, and terrorism isn't part of it. This is a historical choice that Hamas now faces. If they renounce violence, recognize the right of Israel to exist, abide by the previous commitments undertaken by the Palestinian Authority, including the roadmap for peace, the other alternative is they will be facing ostracism from the international community and possible isolation and cutting off of funds and hardship for their people. The choice Hamas makes, therefore, should clearly be made and based on the interests of the Palestinian people and the long-term interests of the people. A renunciation of the path of peace and coexistence with Israel will result in worsening of the conditions of life for all, young and old. It will result in a continuation of the endless cycle of violence that has already destroyed and devastated several generations of Palestinian and Israeli lives. A courageous decision by Hamas to continue the roadmap for peace would actually lay the grounds for further progress. It would renew hope for peace and stability in the region. It would get us out of the stalemate which is now threatening in that region. Very quickly, very soon, the Israelis themselves will be going to the ballot boxes. They too will be faced with momentous choices, and they will have far-reaching consequences. Our hope in Latvia is that Israel's next parliament and its next government will remain just as committed to the peace process as the current administration, thus continuing on a path that, painful as it can be at times, definitely promises hope for a better and more stable future. This is why we will support all constructive endeavors to establish a lasting peace in the Middle East, and of course, as in other parts of the world where conflicts have arisen. The situation in Iraq, I was mentioning, is of course of grave concern, but so is the increasingly belligerent behavior of Iran. Here again, this is something where you are following the news, no doubt, every day, developments are in progress, and the attitude of the Iranian president, of course, gives us all very grave cause for concern. These declarations by the Iranian president, among others, and other events, the increase in terrorism, do indicate that there may not be a clash of civilizations, but there certainly is a chasm between some parts of the Muslim world and Western civilization as a whole. And this does seem to be widening in an alarming way. We saw this with the violence that was elicited by the publications in the Danish and in other European newspapers of caricatures of the Prophet. The violence was palpable, and so was the hatred. It's quite evident that now, more than ever, we have to look for new initiatives to break the vicious circles of hatred and of mistrust, and to start building bridges of mutual understanding. Political leaders, and religious leaders particularly, of all persuasions, have an important role here. We must denounce extremism and violence. We must promote moderation and constructive action. But if you see these screaming, angry crowds, you realize how difficult it is to have a debate with people in that state of emotional arousal. We have to think of new ways. We have to think of ways of reaching children, young people, of reaching people when they're not in an emotionally upset and really distressed situation. We have to manage to catch them when they're in a cool state of mind and engage a dialogue. Unless we do that, this is going to go on and on and on. Prime Minister Zapatero of Spain and Prime Minister Erdogan of Turkey have recently put forward a new initiative together with the Secretary General of the United Nations. It's been termed as an alliance of civilizations. Its goal is to overcome the prejudice, the misperceptions, and the polarization that stand as barriers to better understanding and consensus among Christians, Muslims, and Jews. Latvia fully supports this important initiative, which seeks to establish a genuine paradigm of mutual respect between civilizations and cultures. Needless to say, a task for all nations on this earth is to combat the continuing scourges of poverty, of disease, of illiteracy, all of which fuel illegal immigration, trafficking of drugs, of arms, and of human beings. The disillusionment, the hopelessness in many parts of the world are not necessarily the causes and the only causes, but they certainly contribute to the espousal of radical ideologies, to manifestations of intolerance, to expressions of violence, and of course, to terrorism. Reducing poverty across the globe remains something that we have to do for simply for humanitarian reasons, on moral grounds, but to some extent it will be enlightened selfishness, in that we will be, in that sense, preventing and eliminating breeding grounds for instability, hatred and violence. I don't know that we will ever be able to eliminate it, but the best we can do is to reduce it, and that already would be a great accomplishment. As Special Envoy of the Secretary General last fall, I was able to see at the General Assembly of the United Nations how difficult it is for so many different nations to agree on the reforms. When everybody agrees that reforms are necessary, just about everybody agrees we should change. But the minute we sit down with concrete proposals, and say we should do A, B, C, D, and E, then of course differences of opinion arise. And getting consensus is a very, very hard battle. But it has to be fought, and we have to keep at it. We have to keep talking. We have to keep arguing. I was very pleased to see that the UN General Assembly agreed to the creation of a new peacemaking commission. This is an instrument that the United Nations needs as an effective mechanism for diffusing long-lasting conflicts. Because otherwise, the interventions that we've seen in the past help at that moment in time. And unless you attack the root causes of conflict 5 years later or some years later, the conflict flares up again. The Peacemaking Commission would try and address the root causes of conflict and try to come to long-lasting solutions. This is a very important instrument that the United Nations has now decided to build and to work with. Of course, as you read the news, you know the debate continues about the transformation of the Human Rights Commission into a credible and effective Human Rights Council. Just this morning, the European Union has announced that they are ready to go with a compromise that Mr. Eliasson has managed to achieve. And as you know, no doubt, the representative of the United States feels that the reforms have not gone far enough, that deeper reforms of that body should have been necessary, but it's difficult to get anything that will work unless you have sufficient consensus around the table and enough countries ready to get on board. So this debate continues, and as I say, the latest news is that the European Union is weighing in on the side of the current compromise. Imperfect though it be, they feel that it will be a step ahead, an improvement of what was there before. Regarding the reform of the Security Council, there, of course, the debate promises to be even more difficult and probably more protracted. Latvia as a country, has expressed support to the proposal of Germany, Brazil, and India for the expansion of the permanent members of this important body, rendering it, after all, more representative of the current situation in the world. The current Security Council was created at the very beginning, 60 years ago. The world has changed quite a bit since then. These reforms of the United Nations, along with the reforms, of course, in its governance, in its administration, the Secretary General is coming forth with concrete proposals that it needs. These are very much needed if we are to have an international body that is able to rise up to the many challenges, the global concerns that transcend individual nations, that transcend groups of nations, such as the European Union, but that we have to tackle on a global scale. Ladies and gentlemen, I have been expounding at length on these currently very, I think, important and fundamental questions. And as I look around myself as president and as an individual and as a former psychologist, once a psychologist, always a psychologist, I keep wondering, all these efforts that we put forth, all these new hopes that bloom anew as we found new bodies, international bodies, as countries recover their independence and so on, we are so full of hope, so convinced that we'll build a better world. And then the reality sets in and human nature takes its course and we are again disappointed. But if we look in the long run and if we compare the world today to what it was even in my childhood, then frankly, I think the changes have been fantastic, and they have been for the good. Because when I remember the world of my childhood and the Europe of my childhood, in the middle of the Second World War, we have come such a long way that young people don't even appreciate it. We recently had a debate in Salzburg with young people, in Dresden, in Germany, Salzburg as well. That was another one. And the young people there, when there were seven presidents of European Union countries, and we had a debate with the young people, and some of us said, look, what a long way we have come since then. They said, oh, who cares about that? You know, I was before my time. I don't care. I'm interested, you know, am I going to get a job, and am I going to be well paid, and so on. Am I going to be happy in love, and that sort of thing? Well, of course. It's only natural. But if you look and really evaluate how far we've come, I think we have every ground for being optimistic. All the great dreamers who created the European Union, the great dreamers who created the United Nations, the great dreamers who founded the United States of America, and all those who have always put forth, the founder of the Red Cross, the International, Red Cross having difficulties now, I understand, but a fantastic institution. All these great innovations have improved the world. They have added something. They have changed. They have made our lives better. They have made our lives more humane. And that means, ladies and gentlemen, that we have to keep trying. We have to keep slugging away. We have to keep at it. And make sure that the world that we leave behind is better than the one we found. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Madam President, for those truly comprehensive remarks on strengthening global security. I think, certainly from my perspective, it reminds us of the role that Latvia is playing as a partner that stands really at the crossroads of many of the security challenges you described, especially those in terms of energy, security, enlargement of institutions, but also the kind of personal view that you and your colleagues are bringing from your vantage point in the realm of ideas. And the ideas that are needed in the areas that you also discussed, the rise of political Islam, the search for effective international institutions, the role of international law, etc. So thank you for really taking us down both those paths, both those that are personal to Latvia and those that are personal to you and to your colleagues in Latvia. We have probably about 15 minutes to be able to take some questions and answers. And so therefore, I would like to draw the audience in that's come and joined us today and invite any of you who would like to perhaps pose some questions. If you're going to do this, please identify who you are. I believe we have microphones that will be passed around. And also, could you please keep it to a short question rather than a statement? But let me open it up to the floor and see if anyone would like to step in first. Please, the gentleman here in the middle. Just wait, there's a microphone coming from the other side. There you go. From in front of you. Pincer movement.
William Nassau from the European Institute. Madam President, I was wondering what your view of Russian engagement of Hamas is and what the French endorsement of that engagement is.
I emphasize in my presentation the choices that Hamas has to make. We, in relation to Hamas, also have to make choices, clearly. And this is where it starts getting difficult, because, of course, different tactics are possible. The arguments are they have been elected, they're there, therefore one has to speak with them, clearly. And if we insist on, as an elementary aspect of democracy, the right to participate in votes, something that, for instance, in Belarus we haven't reached yet, then this is a step ahead. And whomever the people elect, then are their representatives. That's usually how we go about it. And this is a paradox, because when they elect a body that does not follow the rules of civilized international engagement and discourse, then you're in a paradox. Do you insist on them accepting the basic rules? In other words, if they are to represent a nation, then an elementary thing in the intercourse between nations is to accept the existence of other nations and not to have as a policy their elimination. Because then there's no dialogue. If their aim is to destroy something else, it's very difficult to have a dialogue with them. the hope of those who wish to engage them is to somehow to persuade them. Otherwise, there is no point. Because if you accept, say, here's a group that whose aim is not peace in the Middle East, it's not the peaceful coexistence of the Palestinian-Israeli people, but of wiping up Israel as a state, how can you have a debate with them? What are you going to debate about? It doesn't make sense.
Thank you very much. The second question? Please, at the front, gentlemen.
Good morning, Madam President. I'm Hunter Abel with National Defense University. My question for you is, you spoke a little bit about the newly developing democracies in Europe, specifically with regard to Ukraine and Georgia, and I wonder if you see parallels between Latvia's own singing revolution in the early 90s and the Orange Revolution that we've seen in Ukraine, the Rose Revolution that we've seen in Georgia, and what you see as the prospect for any future colored revolutions throughout Europe. Thank you.
Certainly the parallels are with our singing revolutions, and this is what I was referring to earlier. Consciousness, the French say, prise de conscience, is becoming aware of, among the population, that you want a change and that you're ready to do something about it. And in Ukraine, you saw people ready to go out in the freezing cold and to stay out for weeks and to protest and say, we will not go on this way any longer. We will not accept rigged elections. We want fair elections. We want our vote to count. It is the determination of the people, their readiness to do something about it, that we saw in the Rose Revolution, and we saw in the Orange Revolution. We saw it in the Velvet Revolution in Czechoslovakia and in the singing revolutions of the Baltic countries. The people are thereby demonstrating a desire and a commitment to change. But that's the beginning. From then on, you need political leaders, you need good programs, you need support from other countries, from allies and friends, to push on with change, to push on with reforms. And it's not easy to do that. It's painful for many. The existing system had many who benefited from it. You have to fight against them now. But there has to be that commitment. And it's really, one has to reach a critical mass among the population of dissatisfaction with now and the readiness to go on. But the interesting thing here was peaceful revolution, very much in the Gandhi spirit, not of destruction, not the 1917 revolution in the Tsarist Empire or the 1905 revolution, with just burning and killing and pillaging, but going out in the street and saying, here we stand, and we want change. And that, I think, there is hope for other nations as well. But it's a very delicate thing. For one thing, you have to be sure that there's not an army that's going to roll in and crush the people with tanks or shoot at them.
Please, at the front. Just the second row, and then the gentleman in front after, please. Mike.
Thank you. I'm Mike Haltzell from the law firm DLA Piper Rudnick Ray Carey. Madam President, at more than one international conferences that I've been at in Europe in the last year, representatives of Russia have asserted in rather emotional and heated way that the Russian minority in Latvia is being deprived of civil rights. I answered at one point that this was a gross mischaracterization of what's going on, but I'm not a Latvian, I'm an American, and I would really appreciate if you could go into some detail about the course of relations between your government and the civil rights of the Russian minority in Latvia.
I think the Russian concern about the fate of what they call their compatriots abroad became particularly acute after events in Chechnya, and when the world started addressing complaints to Russia about what happened in Chechnya. So then, at that moment in time, they became particularly concerned about our compatriots and their rights in Latvia and Estonia, where you have the largest numbers. Curiously enough, we haven't heard concerns about their compatriots in Brighton Beach or in other places in the world, where they are in quite substantial numbers, as it happens. But, of course, we have a situation where we inherited a considerable Russian-speaking population at the beginning of our renewed independence. In fact, the situation in Latvia was getting critical. There was a deliberate process of Russification going on. It was becoming more and more intense and more brutal. And the number, the proportion of ethnic Latvians in, was decreasing steadily, year by year. If we hadn't had independence in 91, I don't know if Latvia would ever have been able to be independent as a country, say, 10 years later. It came at a critical time. When we recovered independence, citizenship was granted to all those who had been in the independent Republic of Latvia, who had been born there, or whose forebears were born there, automatically. Anybody else had to apply for citizenship and could be naturalized. This is still the case. Russia considers this as being grossly unfair. We consider it simply as not enshrining the sequels of a foreign military occupation. Thanks to President Clinton, 80,000 plus troops of the Red Army were withdrawn from our territory in 94-95. We have many cases where in law they're suing in international courts for the right to return to Latvia. They consider it their right to be there for family reunions or what have you. And the other thing they're complaining about is that Latvia restored Latvian as the official language of the country. Because here again, Latvian had been losing ground in the public sphere. In all administrative institutions, Russian was the official language. We have restored Latvian to its rights as a language of discourse in the public space. In the private space, of course, people can speak Russian or Chinese or Japanese or whatever, and we have schools, high schools and public schools in minority languages. We have nearly 200 Russian schools. They are bilingual. They have to learn Latvian as well and teach some subjects in Latvian. They complain about that they have to learn some subjects in Latvian. I was told by delegations that it's a gross insult to their human rights to be asked to learn a Latvian language for the youngsters, that it's going to cause emotional disturbance and neurosis in them and reduce their minds to idiocy. Having said that to myself, who speak 5, 6, 7 languages, I was wondering what kind of level of idiocy I should be at if this is so harmful. And I did point them to certain publications, and notably from McGill University, where I got my doctorate from. But some classmates of mine did the first studies showing that bilingualism increases intelligence, of course. But we are being told that this is terribly harmful to children, it absolutely destroys them. Meanwhile, these children, most of them, are becoming polyglots, really. They speak Latin, they speak Russian, they learn French, they learn English. And the majority of the population is incorporating into everyday life. They have adapted very well. They do particularly well in business, the Russian-speaking part of the population. They do well in sports and in the arts. We're glad to have them. And the number of monolinguals who do not speak any Latvian at all keeps decreasing year by year. We're integrating them into society. But you do have to apply for citizenship if you were born in the Soviet Union, not in Latvia. And it's very easy. 95% of those who apply get citizenship. Well, since we joined the European Union, the numbers have been going up. But they keep being told by Moscow how terribly unfair it is that they do have to apply for citizenship. Otherwise, by the way, our non-citizens have a document of permanent residence, and they have all the access to health care, education, you name it. The only thing that they do not have is the right to say stand for election and to participate in election, to be judges and certain other professions. But otherwise, of course, they actually enjoy all the civil rights of Latvian citizens. We do not have systematic differences in their rights, say, to health care, to education, or anything whatever, employment and so forth.
As you finish there, there was a gentleman waiting patiently for one last question. If we can make it short, because I know that we have to finish in the next 2 minutes. Thank you.
My name is Martin Apple. I am president of the Council of Scientific Society Presidents in the U.S. Europe is probably going to be facing the consequence of something that will attack security that is not based on the kinds of conflict that most people are used to, pandemic flu. It may upset quite a bit. What do you think the preparation level is and what the consequences might be, and what do you suggest?
You name one of the challenges, the sort of challenges that will keep popping up at us. We were never going to be able to live, you know, happily ever after and not have concerns. Avian flu, by now, is reaching our shores. It is now, the last cases are on the island of Rügen in the Baltic Sea, that's very close to Latvia. The migrating birds, of course, spring is coming, the birds are flying north. By now they've reached Germany, as the thaw comes, they will be going north. In other words, they'll be spreading all over Europe. The alarming thing is that there's been a case of a cat found dead of avian flu. That means the virus is mutating. That is the first step of trans-species travel, if you like, of that virus. And in Europe, there's been a debate about it, whether we're having too much alarmist discussions about this, saying, oh, well, it's just the birds dropping dead, you know, never mind. It's only the lobby for the pharmaceutical companies manufacturing vaccines that is making a big fuss about it, and we shouldn't worry about it. At the other extreme, people are falling into a panic and wondering what they should do. In Latvia, we have been vaccinating children and old people for free against the existing strains of flu, at least as to bring up the level of resistance. And we have begged the European Union to allow us, because that's the way the system works, to start vaccinating the poultry in our poultry farms. Because, as you can imagine, the losses to the economy would be tremendous if we have to start systematically slaughtering all the poultry everywhere. But the danger of mutations, of course, this is a tremendous danger, and we're helpless there, because if the virus mutates very quickly, the best that we can do is have vaccinations, even massive vaccinations in a population such as we started to attempt, which will only increase the level of resistance, and then we cannot possibly foresee what the mutations will be.
Madam President, with that last answer, I can definitely say thank you for a truly comprehensive view of the challenges facing European and global security. And thank you also for bringing this personal and strategic sense of the value of the transatlantic relationship as we go forward. We really appreciate your coming here. Thank you very much.